Hello and welcome to Dialect. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out at noon every Tuesday here on BCFM 93.2. This week, Kids Company in Bristol. Why was this London-based charity doing local young people's care? Also, CERN in Switzerland, the particle accelerator in between France and Switzerland. We talked to one of the people that worked there about what's really going on this week. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, who are just off Queen's Square at bristolvolunteers.org.uk, and I'll give their number as well at the end of the show. But we start this week with Sam Downey. Hi, Sam, and welcome to Dialect again. You were on a few weeks ago, weren't you?
Oh, I was, Tony, yes.
We were talking at that time about, is it Happy Cities?
It was indeed Happy Cities.
Happy Cities.
Yes.
Now, this is, I really admire you, Sam, for looking into this, because I look at something like that and I think, oh, it sounds a bit dodgy to me. The idea that because a city is immensely divided, I mean, we hear a lot about equalities, don't we? But we don't hear a lot about the divisions in wealth that are now opening up in this country between people with, you know, reasonable amount to live on, some with quite a lot of savings, property, that sort of thing, and others who have absolutely nothing and really very little prospect of getting a job. If they do get a job, it's a 0 hours contract job where they're not guaranteed any work, and yet they are supposedly to blame for this. Now, this is an appalling state of affairs where the victim is being blamed for the crime almost, and Happy Cities was designed to make everyone feel happy that actually maybe it's your fault that there's something wrong here, and all you need to do is change your attitude and you can be in a happy city. So
change your behaviour.
Yeah, if you change your behaviour, then somehow you'll start feeling much, much better about yourself, even though you're actually been already thrown on the scrap heap by society. So it's about, I suppose, trying to change people's perceptions rather than their circumstances. And it's very patronising. And in a way, it's kind of bullying, you know. So anyway, so that's just to put this in context. Now, Kids Companies hit the headlines over the last couple of weeks as a charity that has not been performing as it should do.
Yeah.
And I'd just like you to introduce to us how Kids Company came to be here in Bristol, because I know when the council stopped taking responsibility for a lot of the young people's activity centres, that kind of thing, there was a move. What they said was, we're going to move over to using local charities. Now, Kids Company is not a local charity. They have quite a large contract, but they're actually based in London. So how did Kids Company come to be here in Bristol?
Kids Company came to Bristol from London. So their headquarters are in London, and they had a lot of funding. And this is part, the funding is part of the Big Society, which a lot of people have heard of, thanks to the Conservatives. And now, with the Big Society, lots of local funding was put into this big pot of money, and Kids Company got quite a bit of it, and we're talking millions here. And Kids Company was kind of set up, people think it was just set up for children who are behaving badly or have been abused or have come from unfortunate family backgrounds, things like that.
So vulnerable in one way or another.
Yeah. But
I mean, the context of this, of course, is 18 to 25 year olds are being treated appallingly at the moment. Very low job prospects. We're going towards the Greece situation where you've got more than half young people without a job. We're not quite there yet, but we're going there. And so to pile difficult family situations and maybe mental situations on young people, as well as having real difficulty in getting a job, I mean, it's almost as if they have no friends in the world. So this is why this sort of provision is so important.
Yeah. I mean, the charity itself with Kids Company, it's so under really a lot of pressure at the moment. Lots of people have been worried about its chief operating officer. But everybody has concentrated on Camilla, called Batman. I'm not going to try and pronounce her
Batman
surname.
Batman Gellish, yeah. Yep, she's this lady you see on TV quite a lot. She's rather large. She wears very colourful clothes and that sort of thing.
Yeah. So So everybody kind of focused on this the mental health aspect of the charity, and the charity actually doesn't state anything about helping people with mental health difficulties on their website. They say that they work with schools, they open up their own learning centres, and parents send their children to these learning centres. They're kind of like afternoon drop-in centres. So while parents are working, their children will go to these centres and be taught more things, and then parents will pick them up later on in the early evening. However, when you think about what this charity did, this charity had a lot of money. And the stories which I've been researching in is on one of the Camilla's specialities. She calls herself a psychologist, but she doesn't have any psychology training at all. In 2010, she wanted to look at the science and research of the effects of fright on the brain.
Okay, fright. Now that's fear on children. Now, okay, so that's a bit of a weird one, isn't it? I wonder if parents of the kids who were being involved in this research were asked about whether they wanted their children to take part in that sort of experiment.
Was there any consent? Well, from what I can gather, there wasn't. It's the research, which I can't find about any information about how much this costed. But basically, research done by Camilla and also UCL, University College London, with a professor there called Peter Frogney, who's the UCL Clinical Educational and Health Psychology Department, has been they're pleased that they were engaged in a groundbreaking study exploring changes in the brain activity associated with successful treatments for children and youth with problems of aggression or antisocial behaviour, many of them whom have been exposed to great trauma and have been raised in various different circumstances. So kind of what they were doing with Kids Company, they wanted to use scanners, MRI scanners and fMRI scanners, to look at children's brains to see why were they angry? Why were they...
Well, that's an interesting one, isn't it? Now, these MRI scans are used for diagnosing, ostensibly anyway, most of the time, they're used for diagnosing things like brain cancer and whatever.
Yes.
And so the idea is that you take a scan of a child or a young person, and the idea being to try and detect something, maybe a blue spot in there, which is causing them to be angry,
at least
using that MRI scan as part of the diagnosis.
Well,
is that right?
That's not entirely right. It's what these scanners do is with the fMRI scanners, that's a functional magnetic response imaging scanners, what they do is they only look at the blood and oxygen levels of where it goes and where blood and oxygen goes within the brain. And that's it. It cannot tell you what emotion goes on in the brain. That's the real science.
I don't know if anything can it, Sam? Can anything tell you what emotion's going on in your brain? Can you scan it and tell you what's happening?
You can't, no. You can use perception, basically, with the people who are scanning your brain. They can perceive that there's certain areas of your brain that's happy, that's angry, but it's only perception. It's a guess, basically.
You know what is starting to creep into my mind here is, mm-hmm. is look, this is going back possibly to some of the CIA's MKUltra style experiments that were being done in the 1950s mm-hmm. and 1960s
Indeed.
In the United States, where scientists, so-called scientists anyway, were trying to see if they could change people's perceptions, change people's attitudes by things like electric shock treatment. And then they were doing scans of their brain as well to see if that had any kind of effect on them. So they're getting, I mean, it seems strange that Kids Company should be getting into that sort of thing. What was the purpose of it? What have Kids Company actually said, and this article I understand in The Spectator as well, has said about what the ostensible purpose of this was then?
Okay, so what they said is... Their chief executive at the time, this is in 2010 when they were doing this research, who commissioned the research with UCL, she said, "Most of us are only programmed to be frightened for short periods without getting some relief. but the 1.5 million children who are abused and neglected every year in the UK are actually being frightened without rest or relief. The consequence is often disturbed behaviours and violence. If the maltreatment of children is altering their developmental pathways, then we are not dealing with children who are morally flawed. The public perception is that these children are just like anyone else until they come to the point of doing something bad. Then the public decides these children have made a thorough decision, when the vast majority will not have thought at all. Their violence was almost instinctive.
Well, hang on, because this sounds a little bit like that film Minority Report, the idea trying to be to detect children who might be going to flip out in some way or be violent before it's even happened.
Mm, yeah, I think it's something like that. But they were also looking for, she was looking for a cure. So for this, a quick fix, basically. So these things won't happen.
Did they come up with any kind of quick fixes?
There was no research released later. I'm trying to find if there's all these research papers are anywhere posted online, and it doesn't seem that there has come anything from UCL apart from two press releases.
It does suggest then that this research might have been privately funded rather than publicly funded, because usually publicly funded research is reasonably easy to find those reports, whereas privately funded isn't. Anyway, interesting to see what Kids Company were up to. But what about the wider question here, which is a lot of this provision that Kids Company were doing used to be done by local government and central government. That is to say, through support, through benefits.
Social security.
Social security, but then also through various forms of social care as well. That is to say, basically things like youth centres, providing youth centres for people. A lot of those now have been privatised. So I put it to you that what's happened here is simply government have shovelled this stuff up onto the charitable and private sector, and now that's starting to fall apart. And the idea really is to make sure that no one's pointing the finger at the government saying, well, this is all your fault.
Yeah, exactly. This is how the government creates a distraction. So they've used Kids Company in this instance, and there's also various, there's lots of other charities probably do it in similar situations around the UK who have used money from the big society to do various things. And the government has kind of like distracted everything and said, okay, no, it's not our fault. Basically, it's a lot of public funding, and it's all this, the public interest funds, I would call it.
I also want to get you to talk a bit, if you can, about your complaint you've made about the Harborside Festival, because that is fascinating to the Advertising Standards Authority. Now, why did you decide that one of the adverts in the Harborside Festival programme, you needed to make a complaint about it? What was it about that advert that you didn't like to see?
Okay,
I know you've got the programme there in front of you.
So the Bristol Harborside Festival took place in Bristol from the 17th to the 19th of July this year. And so I bought a programme, wanted to know what bands were playing, things like that. And I turned to page 11 in the guide, and there I spot a strange advert. And this advert is done by an organisation called Health Creation, promoting personal health mentorship, workplace health and wellbeing consultancy. And this is a training which are wanting to run a foundation course at Bath Spa University, which is accredited training, with optional academic master's programme. And this is what they state very clearly in their advert. And it says, train now with local health leader, and this is the person, Dr. Rosie Daniel, in our unique holistic method, bringing heart, soul and life and energy into coaching for health and wellbeing. Now, the background to Dr. Rosie Daniels was that she, quite a few years ago, did a cancer cure using herbals, so a herbal remedy. And you had a huge amount of doctors laughing in her face because this thing, basically this herbal cure, didn't exist, wasn't a cure, it did nothing, it was nonsense, but lots of people were buying into it. And this doctor was putting a lot of claims to have found this herbal treatment, and she's a very well-known cancer specialist, in the UK and in Bristol at the Bristol Cancer Help Centre, which is now known as Penny Bron. And she's medal director of them. And she has spent years trying to change attitudes towards cancer to encourage her own holistic vision. She's got Prince Charles's backing as a patron of her centre. And her emphasis on treating cancer by diet and healthy living and well-being and positive visualisation, that's one of the keys, and changing lifestyle became increasingly well-known, despite many sceptics like myself. So back in 2004, she put her reputation online by releasing this medical cure and this medical remedy for cancer, which didn't have any medical clinical trials.
But surely, I mean, you know, there's quite a lot of people that would agree, would say, well, cancer, it's probably a good idea to be trying various different types of approaches to it, you know, in order to, in a way, experiment.
Yeah, sure. But this treatment has no treatments to it. And more recently, it's been challenged again and again and again. She keeps pushing these treatments. And it's all based on misleading claims of what she's of what she's doing. And it's based on energies and change. And again, it's the thing that we started off this program, today's program, changing your attitude and behavior to what's going on. So how can you do that with a cancer that's growing in your body? How can you change that cancer development in your brain, for example, which is just about thinking positively about it, and it will go away quite magically?
Okay, so what have the Advertising Standards Authority said about your bringing this to their attention?
So my complaint from the Bristol Harborside Festival program, which I made to the Advertising Standards Agency, they have said to me that they have now carried out an initial assessment of my complaint and have decided that further investigation is needed. This means that they will now contact Dr. Rosie Daniel and her company called Health Creation Limited for their comments on the points of complaints that they're taking forward, which is also governed by the CAP code, which is the advertising code that the Advertising Standards Agency administrators, and it's also a ethical complaint, basically. They've asked them to provide them with the relevant evidence in support of all this claim. So basically, an advert has to be legal, it has to be decent, honest, and truthful. And this advert, basically, what Rosie Daniel states is, and she states that she's running some courses and training at Bath University. You check with Bath University and their website, and also by phoning them up to see if there's any details about this course. And there's nothing about it.
Interesting. Well, I'll tell you what, I don't know if you mind, when you get a final result from your complaint to the Advertising Standards Agency, maybe you could come in and let us know how you get on, Sam.
Sure, I'll be glad to, Tony.
So thanks very much for that, flagging up possible cancer quack cures here in the city, and also some of the backstory, really, to the slow dissolution of this kids' company. Thanks very much, Sam Downey, for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And I'm joined on the line now by Alex Pascal from London. Alex, hi.
Hello, welcome. Tony, how are you doing?
Well, it's lovely to speak to a fellow person that used to work on Radio London. Well, it actually was Greater London Radio many years ago. I worked there in the 1990, 1991. Tell us about how you got started in radio, Alex.
I started with Radio London on air November 22nd, 1974. At that time, BBC Radio London, the local station, we had asked for a program, the Black Community, and I was sort of headhunted through them. And then it took us about, a year to get there. That means we were doing it, preparing for it since 73. And then in November 1974, it went on air, named Black Londoners. That was a name chosen. Very interesting name, because it raised questions on both sides. And that period, everybody used to talk about black people as colored people. And I used to say, which color you mean? And it was once a month on a Friday with a repeat, even with the phone in, on the Sunday evening. And then by 1976, it went once a week. And in 1978, May, it became the first black daily radio program ever in British history. I went down to the Caribbean to create links all around the Caribbean, and that was the buzz of London, because people from anywhere, the black America, USA, Australia, Canada, it's amazing how the program spread itself from being a local program on a local radio station across Britain to help to develop others in the different areas. And it ended in 1988. The Beaver and I didn't get on too well to the end, you know.
Well, look, tell us a bit about the production as well, because, I mean, it's all very well you fronting it, but were you self-producing, or did you have a white or a black producer?
It was Barry Clayton, who was then an ex-Yorkshire television producer, co-founded it with me, Keith Yeomans, who was the executive producer for the education department of BBC Radio London, more or less took charge overall as BBC. But in total, I had to research, present, co-produce. But by the time we got to the once a week, I was then in charge of the program overall. The other people who were there as BBC people mostly came from ILEA in the education office, making education programs. But more or less, I was in charge right from the beginning, because everyone with me were white. They didn't know the black community at that time.
So you were able to reach out.
It mushroomed.
It did.
From
sounds like it
zero
did.
And became quite an international program, really. People coming from anywhere. There was a Thursday part of the weekly program, which I call Visitors to London. And I would just get calls. People would turn up in front of Radio London. If you picked up a black person to go to the BBC, the taxi driver had to be careful, because they all drove them right on to BBC Radio London. You know, some funny things to look back to this at this moment.
Yeah, well, take us back to the 70s. What was the attitude to black people within the BBC then?
It was rough, to say the least. It was the police and the panda cars, a sus on the streets. Intimidation, all told. Even a person like me, who was coming out of show business and coming in, you would be just stopped ridiculously by the police. The black community, the temperature was building. I remember doing a lot of work in Lewisham in one area, then across the South Hall area, and so you had to have not black militants, but black men, young, who had to be helping these young children on the way from school or so, because the police was just running havoc with them. Race relations wise, this country was quite distant. They didn't know the geography or where we came from. So Radio London then became like a school through black Londoners, and a program which happened before me, Reggae Time, but Reggae Time only played with Steve Barnard. That only played reggae music. When I came in, I played the general music of Africa, the Caribbean, the standards of black America, because the Motown period, all the white stations, Radio 1 would play that, Radio London, but nobody was playing black music per se from the Caribbean people who were here. Music from the Caribbean was getting no coverage. So that all came through the program that I was doing, Black London.
But the biggie surely has got to be the riots. I mean, we had them here in Bristol, in St. Paul's, Toxteth.
The riots was a stinging piece, especially Bristol, Liverpool, Brixton. I had to cover all those. I could never forget Brixton 1981. 1981 as a whole was a riotous year, because you came from the New Cross fire, the 13 people who got burnt in New Cross. That led into the rage of Margaret Thatcher and what she said. I mean,
I mean, if I can just interrupt you a second.
At that time, I'm not slagging parking.
Alex, if I can just interrupt you a second, because I can remember driving through Brixton during the time of the riots. It really was like a total no-go zone, a bit like Northern Ireland, I guess.
It was. No, I could take you back to the scene when I remember taking a cab, getting down to Brixton, getting off, and I went to the inspector who was on the street there. I had my microphone in my hand, and I made sure to label up the tape recorder I had to show that I was from the BBC. And there were not many black men coming from the BBC at that time, I tell you that. And I went to the superintendent or the inspector. I said to him, excuse me, I just want to let you know that I'm from BBC Radio London, and I will be going down there to cover. And he looked at me and he smiled. He says, son, look at my men who are down there. They are frightened at this moment. Can I tell them that you're another black man and to look after you? He says, I'm afraid we are all on our own today. And when I went to Radio London, the managers to say, well, I'm going down to Brixton. I would like to take the radio car. They told me, no, I can't take the radio car. I went to Robbie Vince and I said, okay, Robbie, why don't you come with me? Robbie said, no, you can broadcast to me from there, but no way will I go to Brixton. It was a frightening period.
So what do you put it down to, the violence at that time? Because it was just after the victory of the Conservatives and Margaret Thatcher, wasn't it?
Yes. Margaret, she had made that statement about swamping. And then that followed by something that happened to a number of children who got killed in Northern Ireland. And Her Majesty and others, as a matter, sent condolences to the people in Ireland, but never said anything about the 13 blacks who got killed in New Cross. That leading into the Brixton riot, that year was the death of Bob Marley died that year too, 81. That's right. And then the Pope and all, if you remember, across the world got stabbed. Was it something of the sort? It was a hell of a year, not only in Britain, but across the world. The things were really tough.
So what about wheeling on to the end of the 80s and the beginning of the 90s, where I think we just both missed each other at Marylebone High Street in the old building, the old Radio London building under at the bottom of the Radio
it's
Times.
It's interesting to look back to the old building, you know, because that was only the Radio Times. Radio London began in 13 Hanover Square, just off Oxford Circus there. And nobody knew Radio London, really. I think the black people got to know it because of reggae time. The Asian people got to know it because there was a program there, you do London Songs Eastern. So those minority programs helped to publicize Radio London. Even Capital, that came after Radio London, became much more popular. LBC, firing on the air, but when we got in there, black Londoners, then you don't have to be Jewish. Likewise, the minority programs that helped to bring more enlightenment to minorities all came through local radio, but in particular, BBC Radio London.
Did you ever feel management pressure on you to treat subjects in a way which you weren't entirely happy with?
The managers differed. I think the problem came from the ignorance of the big beef in its own. The managing director, like Aubrey Singer, we had a face-to-face battle. He came down as director general, down to the basement where I was at BBC Radio London, when things were pretty rough, and I could never forget that man. He was so rough, his attitude, his swearing. I think I lost respect for the Beeb from then on. But let me go back, because I met Peter Redhouse was the one we met, but within 6 months he was gone. Then came Alan Holden. That man is the man that is responsible for really helping me, setting the program alight, because he stated when he came, I'll give the program 6 months trial, live or die afterwards. And he then put something in, sent me to the Caribbean, so that was mighty. The newsroom was odd. There was one person whose name I wouldn't call. But he was so daft. I don't think there were lovely guys in the newsroom. But that one person, I don't think I ever got on well with him. He tried everything to have a go at me. Then I can move to the next manager, Derek Amo. He was a great guy. He defended his staff. But boy, we had some ding-dong dings. He left me there. And I think he went off, but he died. And then the last one who came when they switched from Radio London to GLR was Bannister. He knew nothing about me. He rang me on telephone to say, don't come back. It's a long story that I'm writing about. You see, the politics of that time was deep in the Beeb. I had accused the BBC of being racist. I mean, later on, the director general, what do you call him, who said that it's whiter than white, he was saying it years after I did. The Beeb was not easy. I am not saying everybody, you know. I'm speaking about the attitude in general of the Beeb needed a lot of education to even bring it to what it is today.
Well, today, Alex, of course, we know much more about things like the Jimmy Savile scandal, also about, you know, vetting, things like that, weeding people out who were seen to be challenging the government. And we had a former chairman of the BBC recently saying it's in danger of becoming part of the government. Now, Matthew Bannister, when I was there, I mean, he was the manager at Radio London, or GLR. Yes. What was his background? I mean, you say he didn't know anything about you.
Bannister came from Capital and he came straight in. He didn't know me, but I remember having a private meeting with him to decide whether I would stay or not. And there were certain things I told him that I didn't like. And I have a feeling because I said that to him, I became persona non grata. It didn't matter at all.
A good manager, surely, Alex, is going to take a little bit of criticism. They're going to, you know, they're not going to take that personally.
He can't take criticism. You see, there are some managers, you're right about taking a good manager's give and take. That was Amo. He gave and take. Alan Holden, the staff feared him, but he gave and take. But this guy just walked in with another friend of his called Trevor. And together, they were like a bulldozer, you know. They must have come in to do a job. And so I wouldn't say that he knew. Maybe in a way he knew absolutely nothing. But again, people have their positions and they get in. I wish him well. I listen to him every now and then on music and I think to myself, oh, you had some intelligence. I didn't realize he had some intelligence on music, but I don't think much of him, frankly. I'm just finished in my book called Order in the House, based on the cameras going into the House now of Parliament and looking at all the things, some of that of which I went through at Radio London and other places, the state of racism here, the United States and other places, because things have changed somewhat. But underneath that water, the oil on the water, there is still simmering racism salt. It's just covered up.
Well, I mean, maybe you've got some comments about what's been going on the last couple of weeks in Ferguson, because it does seem as if these Oath Keepers, these sort of mostly white guys with guns, are being brought along to try and turn what is ostensibly a problem of poverty into a kind of race war in the United States. So I just wonder what you think, you know, whether you agree with that and whether you think that there's a danger of that sort of thing happening in Britain.
Yes, the same is happening in Britain, but Britain has a sophisticated way of hiding things. We are the most diplomatic country in the world, I think, Britain. I like the form of diplomacy, but I prefer a man to tell me to my face, go to hell, than to say, oh, you know, Alex, you're a nice guy, and so on. We're very patronizing in this way. It's a lovely country. It has a lot going for it. We've had to fight to bring it where it is. But Lord have mercy, the hypocrisy is so disguised now that even to the indigenous white people, it is not fair. The gaps on race is wide, on economics is wide. We are going back to the early period where just a few people in this country wants to control. And there are specific ones who go through certain schools that are within the Beeb itself and other parts of the society. They believe that they are in charge. I'm really pleased to see what's going on with Jeremy Corbyn at this time, because what do you call left and right here? There is left, there is right, there is right, there is wrong. We need to take a general look at ourselves here in Britain and in the media, likewise, where you and I are. We used to seem to have more rapport before. Nowadays, everything is so highly controlled. Even Question Time has lost its sting.
You're absolutely right. I totally agree with you there. And that's why we try and float some a little bit more wider ideas out on our show here, Dialect. Anyway, we're going to finish up with this song, Weeting, Notting Hill Carnival. Can you tell us about that?
I just wanted to bring this in because the most political thing I've ever had to face was the Notting Hill Carnival that I managed for 5 years. And within that time, the troubles I had with it, trying to keep it in the cultural sphere of what it is. And at the end, I decided to write a poetic narrative called Weeting Notting Hill Carnival. It is ours, that means the people's. So the story that is written in that little book, people are downloading it now because I'm doing a lot voice-wise as well as the little booklet. And it speaks the language, the rhythm, the culture and everything else. I hope people do like it because it's factual.
And also we have our St. Paul's Carnival here every year, which has been cancelled this year. Have you got any advice for those who are working around that about how you put on a really good carnival that's genuine?
I used to go a lot around the country even in I would love to come and do a lecture or a workshop or something to the people. It's no more black, let us forget about that, to create a carnival here that has what we can call a Caribbean feeling. We must go through the schools, build it through the schools so that young people will learn. If there are those listening up there and they feel they would like me to do something, they can certainly get in touch with me. Because many of them should know me very well still up there, you know.
Okay, before we hear Weeting Notting Hill Carnival, how do people get in touch with you, Alex?
www.goodvibesonline, all in together, .co.uk. Otherwise, email me, gvrm@email.com. gvrm@email.com. And it's nice, man. When you're back down here again, we must sit down and have a little chat. I would be delighted for us to get a few more of the people of yesterday, like myself, and those who are GLR, and sit down, if we can, and tell the truth.
Okay, thanks very much, Alex Pascoe. And we'll leave you now with Weeting Notting Hill Carnival. Now, when was this recorded?
That was recorded just after I finished in 1989-90, when myself and Paul Condon was then head of the Metropolitan Police. It exposes everything that they were trying to do or did to the carnival.
Alex Pascoe, thanks very much for joining us.
You're a gentleman, thank you.
People jumping in the band, police milling round and round and round. Action on the bridge, the carnival under siege. Newsmen running wild, tempers flying high. Not a smile from man, woman, or child. Me dear, Miss Lolita, which you wrote this stall, she start to bawl. Bungie, music stop, mass stop, roadblock, riot start.
Mr. Speaker, the year 1976 was blue, bottle, and sticks.
We carnival turn old mass. Yes, we carnival this Notting Hill Festival. Before 1965, we strive to keep alive this glorious celebration derived from emancipation, exploitation, deprivation, and immigration. We carnival, the pride and joy of a Caribbean nation, on narrow streets where people meet people in a joyful ripple of nostalgic action, feeling high in an atmosphere. Eating and drinking, we can a red stripe and carry beer, rum, roti, mobby, fried fish, rice and peas and we ginger beer. Make this carnival we annual affair. Yes, we think this Notting Hill Carnival. Mass music and movement throughout the year in Leeds, Leicester, Liverpool, Manchester, Preston, Bristol, Huddersfield, Oxford, Birmingham, Reading and Swindon, in the boroughs of Brent and Waltham Forest. See, is we carnival jamming from London City to Holland, Paris, Nice and Italy, twin land and sea, all are we jamming. Every August bank holiday we jamming, from night till 40 morning, all saints, sinners, police and thief, ragamuffin and nun, politicians and priests jamming. Inside, outside, front and backside jamming, mass music and serious movement. In and out the grove, man and woman jamming. In the rain, singing a constant refrain we jamming. Shot me tramping up and down, shadow playing history mass like Jesus carrying the cross. John with the quattro singing all masses, boss. from north to south. People come from all about jamming Mangrove, Tabernacle, Powys Square, under the bridge, and meanwhile gardens is song jamming. With soak on the moves, we carnival is a party groove. But since you come to celebrate the funding system best we get, and so in 1988 they orchestrate commercial hit with a live band, mass debate, and a police raid on December 8th. Lord, you should see them snakes celebrate man, woman, and song. But for how long? I've seen and heard it all before and after late. Sister John, not fret, not stoop. Just wait. You thought you had seen and heard it all to date. Should the press, TV, and radio? Well, well, surprise, surprise. Take five, take five. I'll summarize 1989. No panorama, no gala, no bleachers. Just more police, journalists, and horses. And a zeppelin, a big, big floating balloon flying high in the sky, suckling Notting Hill with the bill. Like a pirate ship, full of tricks. Space drama without a mama. Come 7 o'clock, all roads block, cops start to flock. In bright daylight, sunshine in not dark, them tell we party done, home bound. And that's not all, is what happened to them people stall. Lord, I start to bawl till I reach Kensington Town Hall. Is then the penny drop, bah, who that? Yes, is who that get a piece of the Berlin Wall with us, Even that and all. Yes, master, top prize. Congrats. What a police bacchanal. God, give we back we carnival. Stop this police bacchanal. Give we back we festival. Yes, is we ting this Notting Hill carnival.
What? What you say? They want to stop the carnival?
Bossman.
Selector. Music. Turn on the music. Let me play mass.
Come, let me jam. Jump in the line and shake your body line. Let me go. Tempo. Chorus. Look, man, no play the ups. Look. Wine, flag woman, wine. Is we carnival.
Last wine. Put your hand around my waist and wine.
Play mass. Play the bass. Wine, Mr. Pong, wine. Shake your bum. Wine, dollar bill, wine. Wine like a ball of twine.
Wine, Lira, wine, Yen, wine, Mark, wine, Frank,
wine. Everybody, wine. That is fair. The whole of Europe winding up and down London Town. White wine, red wine, wine. You can't wine. Jock your waist and wine. Wave something and wine. Gee whiz. Look with people wine. From head to toe to pan reggae and kaiso. Wine with sparrow. Wine. Lego. Now put your hand in the air and shake it. Come on. Everybody shake it. Jump to the beat. Drag your feet. Feel the heat and shake it. Shake it on the street. Come on. Shake it up and down.
Look. Take off your suit and shake you.
Lord. Bang on to she head, she body. Look the rhythm on she waistline. Play mass. Mass in your mass. Mass annoy you. The bell in disguise.
You're jamming, man.
This thing got carnival nice. I feel it nice.
Stop with carnival. We carnival is we thing. That's Notting Hill carnival. Say back, I knew Notting Hill carnival, seller. Pass the bottle. Let me celebrate. Give me a drink, let me celebrate. Nobody could stop this carnival. It's we thing. Carnival is we thing. Say back, I knew. Not for sale, officer, not for sale. It's we thing. Say back, I knew.
Let me play mass.
We carnival is boss. Let me play mass. Give me tempo. Baby.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
And joining me now is Angela Balassi. Hi, Angela.
Hello, Tony.
What have you got for us this week? I think I can see you with a copy of the Western Daily Press there.
That's right. And the farmers are still protesting over the price of milk. This comes after Morrison's has put an extra 10p on the price of its Morrison's Milk for Farmers, and they're calling for other supermarkets to follow suit.
So why are farmers in this sticky situation then?
Well, it costs between 30 and 32p to produce a litre of milk, whereas the average price across the UK is 23p. So obviously they're making a loss. So they're calling for, I suppose, a fairer deal.
Surely farmers get quite a lot of money, subsidies. Aren't they just, I hate to say it because it's referring to sheep, not cows, but bleating over this?
Well, Morrison's have actually said they're now going to ask suppliers not to pass on further cuts in farm gate price and for it to benefit the dairy farmers. So there does seem to be a suggestion that they haven't been the ones directly benefiting from these price increases, for example.
Now, this is all about the free market, isn't it? There is a free market in milk. Sometimes the price goes up, sometimes the price goes down. Surely it's just tough for the farmers.
Well, again, Morrison says that their main supplier is Arla, and it uses a cost model that automatically adjusts the price that we pay. And this is based on a combination of the farm gate price and other commodities such as diesel and plastics, which influence the cost of milk. So yes, it would indicate that the price of milk changes according to other factors as well. And also, I suppose, it's demand. So they're saying that they're supplying more than there is a demand for at the moment.
Now, are you old enough to remember the Milk Marketing Board?
Possibly I'm old enough, but I don't remember it.
Okay, well, it was set up in 1933 and it was abolished under Margaret Thatcher a little bit later. I'm not exactly sure about the date, sometime in the 1980s, I think. But back in under the Milk Marketing Board, farmers were guaranteed a price. Now, the reason why I suppose 1933 is significant is because that was just after the Great Depression. And so when the international markets are meaning that farmers cannot actually, they're not getting enough money in order to feed the cows and that sort of thing, the government decided that this was a strategic industry, milk is a very basic foodstuff, and that they would intervene to make sure that there was a separate price. But that system doesn't exist anymore.
No, and Morrison's have introduced, well, I suppose a choice, and which they're hoping other supermarkets will follow. And with Morrison's, though, it's a Morrison's Milk for Farmers, and they said they're offering the customers a choice to support farmers. So it would appear that they're still going to be offering other milk at a cheaper price, and then the onus will be on the buyers whether or not they choose to support farmers or not.
The Milk Marketing Board used to sponsor the milk race, cycle race tour of Britain up until 1993. So I must imagine it was actually after the end of Margaret Thatcher that it was abolished. So surely we should be thinking here about strategic industries like milk. It's just simply not good enough to be in a situation where farmers are making a loss supplying milk, which is something that society needs. So how do we deal with this sort of situation? I mean, imagine if it's water and the water companies are saying, well, actually, we're going to go bust. We cannot allow that sort of thing to happen.
Well, I'd agree. And many farmers are saying they have had to quit and that it was no longer, you know, a viable business for them and that they couldn't support their families. And many of, to begin with, downsized and so on and so forth, but they did get to the point where they could no longer continue, and I imagine that could only get worse if it's not addressed. And I agree, something I suppose needs to be done.
Well, I wonder if Jeremy Corbyn, this is one of the things he's been thinking about, because we've had his name crop up, haven't we, as the front runner at the moment in the Labour Party leadership contest, and he's talking about nationalising many of these industries. Now, I wonder whether that includes compensation for the people that currently own those industries. If the government is actually going to intervene and say, well, we're going to guarantee prices for people, then that sounds to me like a socialist government, and that's not something the Tories are going to like.
No, but possibly the farmers would.
Well, we'll see. I mean, I also, just to, as an anecdotal point, I can remember having a chat to a guy who just finished a field. I think he was, harvesting it or something. He was sitting on a tractor and got into conversation with him up in Wiltshire. And this is just before you get to Swindon, just around that area somewhere. Got chatting to him and he said, oh, you do realise this? All this land used to be Milk Marketing Board. So the Milk Marketing Board wasn't just involved in processing milk it actually owned farms. So the vast amounts of milk were produced by intervention, basically by not allowing a free market. Problem is, the free market doesn't always deliver. So we've also seen this week, Angela, we've seen farmers actually bringing cows into supermarkets. So what's the point of that?
Well, I suppose it's to raise awareness and to make their point. They've also stocked up milk, put it in their trolleys. And that seems to be gaining interest and gaining momentum.
Okay, so how is this all going to resolve itself? You gaze into your crystal ball. What do you think? Because if there's going to be any intervention, it doesn't seem like that's going to happen with a Tory government, does it?
Well, it seems that the pressure's been put on the supermarkets as opposed to the government at the moment. And if Morrisons have already increased the price, then possibly, I imagine, other supermarkets will follow.
Okay, Angela Balassi, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect to discuss the milk crisis, so-called crisis anyway. Hopefully it's only a crisis for the farmers and it will be sorted out as soon as possible. Thanks, Angela.
Thank you.
That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2. at noon every Tuesday. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Sorry, we didn't have time for the CERN feature with Sabine McNeil, who used to work there. That'll be on next week. Thanks to our guests that did make it. That's Sam Downey, Alex Pascal, and you just heard there Angela Balassi, also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. You can contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
As I was walking down Birmingham Street, in me fine scarlet coat and everything neat, enough to entice all the maidens that day, when they set their eyes on you, ramble away, oh ramble away, oh ramble away. When they set their eyes on you, ramble away. The very first steps I took into the fair, I saw pretty Nancy a-combing her hair. I gave her the wink and she rolled her black eyes. Thinks I to myself, I'll be there by and by. There by and by, oh, there by and by. Thinks I to myself, I'll be there by and by. As I was a-walking that night in the dark, I took my bright Nancy to be my sweetheart. She smiled in my face and these words she did say, are you the young man they call Ramble Away? Oh, ramble away, oh, ramble away. Are you the young man they call Ramble Away? I said, pretty Nancy, don't smile in my face, for I don't intend to stay long in this place. Well, I gave her three doubles and fair length and share, and I told her I'd ramble the devil knows where. Oh, devil knows where, oh, devil knows where. I told her I'd ramble the devil knows where. Well, when 24 weeks they were over and past, this fair pretty maid, she did sicken at last. Well, her gown would not meet, nor her apron string stay. And it was all through the love of young Ramble Away. Oh, ramble away, oh, ramble away. It was all through the love of young Ramble Away. So come all you fair maids, where'er you may be, with courting young fellas, don't make yourselves free. For if you should do so, you'll rue the sad day when you met with the likes of young Ramble Away. Oh, ramble away, oh, ramble away. Met with the likes of young Ramble Away. It was a pleasant summer's morning as we left Brentford Pier. The wind was blowing south-south-west, the air was warm and clear. Five swans were drifting down the tide, five clouds were in the sky. And the oil and mud was breaking white in spray as we passed by. At Waterloo we met the trains arriving from the west. The old stockbrokers piling out, all hot and neatly dressed. We passed their banks and office blocks and saw them crammed up tight. And there we lay and watched the sky and drifted down the tide. Well, I've known this river flowing clear before the diesels came. You used to pull your punts at night and you'd play the nighttime game. At Brentford Reach you'd dip your mug to drink when you were dry. Could see the swan's feet trailing white to turn and let you by. But the men who rowed the barges then, they now were old and grey. And the river's gone to oil and mud, and they've watched the job decay. And aching limbs and worn out spines are all the thanks they've got. One day they'll dam the whole Thames up and let the lighters rot.